My name is Jerry Diamond, and I am from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I'm the ALC pastor of a very small house church there. Does that mean I'm not speaking loud enough?
No, that's
right. Okay.
I don't know what a house church is.
Okay, well, it's a church that doesn't have a building.
Oh.
So we meet in homes. And on the way over here, I said to somebody, I think I'll walk down to the village center and see what's happening. And that's a sign that I've gotten more relaxed and nonchalant about being here. I have been here 3 weeks now, and the first week I came to these sessions with absolute fear and trembling and butterflies in my stomach and all that kind of thing, and now I'm kind of relaxed. Somebody said about Thomas Merton, the monk that went into the Gethsemane Monastery when he was a young firebrand, he walked in, this is sort of a way to characterize Thomas Merton, he walked into the monastery with Thoreau in one pocket, St. John of the Cross in the other pocket, and the Bible open to the apocalypse. Which gives you some idea probably of what kind of a mentality he had. Well, I walked in here with Thoreau in one pocket, but I don't have St. John of the Cross, and I don't have the Bible open to the apocalypse. I suppose if you've been going to some sessions today that had to do with the issue of the day and peace and all that kind of thing, you might think you walked into the middle of the apocalypse. I went to the Lowell Erdahl and Jerry Polk session this morning in this room, and perhaps you need a little respite from that. That's a very terrifying and a heavy kind of thing. I had set up in my head to do today the topic of celebration of disciplines before they decided that the day would be devoted to peace, but I see there's no inconsistency. In fact, in my feeling, disciplines are certainly a fundamental way to approach the subject of peace from a Christian perspective. Let me just ask a question of you folks. Is this mic recording too, so people's questions can be heard? Put this close enough here that you have responses or whatever you want to call it. Well, that's a popular idea of the word discipline. I think it often is used that way. Disciplining a child might mean spanking the child or something like that. And I think that the word is often used in church circles that somebody is under discipline. It sounds like a bad thing, you know, and it probably is. So let me just say a couple of words to begin with. What I am not talking about when I use the word discipline, I'm not talking about laws. Okay, they are not rules or laws. They are not legalisms. I'm not talking about placing somebody under some kind of excommunication. That sometimes is how the word discipline is used. Church discipline, they have been disciplined. They are on the outs somehow. It is not dropping somebody from membership. It is not putting somebody on the inactive list in your church. That is not what I mean by discipline. It has nothing to do with law, nothing to do with legalisms whatsoever. As a matter of fact, it has nothing to do with somebody else at all. It has to do with me. I mean, the discipline has to do with me, and for each one of us, it's for yourself. Or, let me say opposite now, what it is taking discipleship seriously. You see, the word discipline and the word disciple are the same root. So, to get into some kind of a disciplined Christian life is to take discipleship seriously. It is to get into a posture to receive grace. It is not a law to somehow earn something. It is just simply a way to get into a stance to receive the gift. It's a way to grow. Discipline is a choice. A decision that we make about something is a conscious effort to open up to sanctification, is what the church uses that big word, which is basically, I think, is letting the Holy Spirit shape, mold, guide, teach, instruct, inform, nurture, fertilize, water, bless, increase faith and works. In short, it's to grow toward the full image of Christ, full image of the Master. And I would say at the outset, rather bald-facedly, without discipline, there is no spiritual life. If you're involved somehow in what you consider to be spiritual growth or spiritual life, and you have no disciplines to do that with, really I think it's just about impossible, or at very best, without discipline, all our spiritual growth will be stunted and thwarted and short-circuited and starved and dried up. Use words like that to describe no discipline. Let me just talk for a second about the word spiritual disciplines, because I knew a man in a parish I served one time who used the word spiritual a great deal. He pronounced it spiritual, and spiritual things for him had nothing to do with this earth. And he was always saying, well, we ought to be involved in spiritual things around here, you know, and it had nothing to do with the drug culture that was right outside the front door of the church. Had nothing to do with the war in Vietnam, which was going on. It had nothing to do with racism, which was raging all about us. We should be doing spiritual things. So when I say spiritual, I do not mean pietistic or pietism. I do not mean otherworldly, ethereal, body-denying, directed only at the soul, lacking in any kind of relevance to the world around us, or a way to avoid critical social issues. I do not mean a holier-than-thou kind of pietism, a one-up personship. Why? Well, say one-upmanship. Can't say that here. One-up personship. A heavenly rather than earthly. I don't mean the word spiritual in that way. Spiritual disciplines are here and now, concerned with this, with our life, right here and now. I don't know where else they'd be what else they'd be concerned with, but here and now. They involve the whole person. They are in fact ways to make concrete the commandment that you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. That's a nice saying. Jesus then does not spell out how you go about doing that. Spiritual disciplines can somehow give us an avenue to love God with our mind, or with our heart, or with our soul, or with our bodies, and to love our neighbors as ourselves. And there are three commandments there, by the way. We often think of them as two, but we are to love God and our neighbor as ourselves, which implies the third commandment, loving oneself. So that's a part of it. Ask a question, are spiritual disciplines new? Is that something that just sort of dropping down upon us because of the ecumenical movement? We're getting rubbing shoulders with Catholics and we hear that they fast. In fact, they've given that up, I think. But are these new disciplines? No. Spiritual disciplines are only new in the sense that God's grace is new each morning. But I think that there are some, there are classical spiritual disciplines, and they're not particularly anything new. Let's see how many of you can, how many spiritual disciplines we can toss out here. Prayer.
Prayer.
Prayer, all right. Another one.
Reading the Bible.
Hmm? Worship.
Reading the Bible.
Okay. And worship, I heard. Okay, how about another one?
Meditation.
Right?
Fasting.
Study.
Study. Okay, I'll put that up there with Bible. I guess it could be other kind of study too. Any more?
Witnessing.
Huh?
Witnessing.
Witnessing? Okay. I don't know if you can read my writing or not.
Tithing.
Huh?
Tithing.
Tithing? Okay.
Solitude.
Solitude. Service. Service. Okay. You notice I'm putting them in separate columns here. Reason? Anything else that people can think of?
Listening.
Listening, okay. Put that one over here.
Oh, sacrifice.
sacrifice. Okay.
Well, that's a pretty good list of disciplines. Let me throw a couple more on here that I've got jotted down. There's one here that I want to put in called simplicity. I can't remember. I'll go here.
Would that also be denial?
Well, denial.
That'll be sin and sacrifice.
That's one I heard that's been talked about here already, is submission. There's one here. Another one I'd like to stick over there is guidance. Another one I'd like to stick over here is celebration. Okay, basically, the three columns we've got here would be disciplines that are inner disciplines, and these are disciplines basically which are outer disciplines, and these are disciplines that are core that we do with the whole community. Okay, what I'm doing is following the title of this session from the book Celebration of Discipline by Richard Foster, and I'd like to just read a little bit from this book. The classical disciplines of the spiritual life call us to move beyond the surface into the depths of things. Superficiality, he says, is the curse of our age. They invite us to explore the inner caverns of the spiritual realm. They urge us to be the answer to a hollow world. John Woolman counseled, "It is good for thee to dwell deep, that thou mayest feel and understand the spirits of people." So you see, the spiritual discipline is not an end in itself, but so that thou mayest discern or understand the spirits of people. We must not be led to believe that the disciplines are for spiritual giants and beyond our reach, or for contemplatives who devote all their time to prayer and meditation. Far from it. God intends the disciplines of the spiritual life to be for ordinary human beings, people who have jobs, who care for children, who must wash dishes and mow lawns. In fact, the disciplines are best exercised in the midst of our normal daily activities. If they are to have any transforming effect, the effect must be found in the ordinary junctures of human life, in our relationships, husband and wife, our brothers and sisters, friends and neighbors. So it's a way, the spiritual disciplines, I think, are a way for us to move beyond superficialities. So, I mean, much of life that I encounter, and maybe that you encounter, and much of my own life even, sort of skims across about the upper 1 inch of the surface of the vast ocean that lies beneath it. Well, are they drudgery? Reading again from Foster, he said, "Neither should we think of the spiritual disciplines as some dull drudgery aimed at exterminating laughter from the face of the earth. Joy is the keynote of all the disciplines. The purpose of the discipline is liberation from the stifling slavery to self-interest and fear." Now, that's a theme that he brings out in this book over and over again, that the purpose of a spiritual discipline is liberation. And with every spiritual discipline, I won't be able to go through all these and talk about them very much, but every single one of them is designed to get at some form of liberation. They are not drudgery. When one's inner spirit is set free from all that holds it down, that can hardly be described as drudgery. Singing, dancing, even shouting characterize the disciplines of the spiritual life. So there's a deep, deep joy that one begins to experience as you get down deeper into some spiritual discipline. And but that, I don't mean by that a plastic smile. I've been around people who are Christians who have a smile that's just etched in their face. I went to a a meeting one time at the YWCA in Kalamazoo. It was an all-day kind of thing, but it concluded with a group, young Christians, who gave a concert. They had guitars and they sang Christian songs and what have you. But the leader of the group was a woman, young woman, she's maybe 25 years old. And I tell you, literally, for about 45 minutes, she sang and talked to us, and for 45 minutes, she had a smile on her face. It never vanished. I begin to wonder a little bit about that kind of smile. But I'm talking about a deep, deep kind of almost unspeakable joy. What are some of the problems of getting at spiritual disciplines? I think in our world, part of the problem is that the inner world is almost non-existent to us. I mean, in our culture, we are so steeped in materialistic things that we even doubt that there is anything beyond materialism. So I think that we are shaped in our culture in materialism. We are shaped by a kind of scientific determinism, and we take that as being, you know, that's the real world, and we doubt that there is anything more beyond that. Now, we may not think that out consciously, but that's sort of implicit, I think, very often in how we act. So if I cannot perceive it with my five senses, it ain't there. Spiritual discipline will begin to lead you to find out that there's much more there. I remember church council meetings, and you experienced this in your parish where you are now. We don't have a church council in our church because the church is so small that whenever we get together, we all get together, and we all decide everything. So we don't have to set that some things aside for somebody called the church council. But that was often referred to as doing the business of the church. Now, I'm not denying that that's part of the business of the church. In fact, very often someone would open the meeting with a prayer, and they would ask God to guide us as we do the Lord's business. The problem was, as I kind of perceived what was going on, was that the council meeting dealt almost exclusively with the building, the structure that we were sitting in, and the insurance payment that was coming due, or the balloon payment on the mortgage that was coming due, or the organ needed to be tuned, or the utility bills needed to be paid, or the shrubbery had to be replaced, or there was a leak in the roof, and that this was the real business of the church. That was really concrete, in the real world, the real business. And very often the person who offered the prayer at the beginning didn't really even think that the prayer was the business of the church too. So we need to kind of get beyond the things that we can perceive with our senses. I think that Jesus took the spiritual disciplines very, very seriously. And there are many spiritual disciplines that are mentioned. In fact, I would suspect that every one of these here are mentioned in the scriptures, and we could find some Bible passages that would point to them. I remember, for example, one time the disciples were trying to cast some sort of a demon out of a young child, and they were just frustrated, and they couldn't do it, and people were arguing, and Jesus comes up and says, "What are you arguing about?" And he said, "Well, your disciples tried to take care of this problem, and they can't seem to help at all." And Jesus' response was, I don't know if you remember this one, but this kind of a demon can only be driven out by prayer and fasting. Now, you see, very often we just would dismiss fasting as really important at all. Now, what did Jesus mean by that? Well, he doesn't tell us what he meant by it, because I'm sure that everybody who heard him knew what was meant by fasting. We don't know anymore. We have given it up. And maybe we should take a second look at a discipline like fasting and what that means. I think that's one reason that the spiritual disciplines seem to be a little difficult for us. The materialistic, surfacey world in which we live. Another reason I think that they're difficult, and the second reason I'm going to give two, is that in a sense we are so removed from classical spiritual disciplines that we have forgotten how. Like fasting. We don't know why you fast. We don't know what it is. We just know that it's like not eating, so it's a pain in the neck. You know, I don't go all day without eating. I get pain in my stomach or something like that. And we don't know how to go about it. Fortunately, we're not bounded as Christians by time. So when we confess that with the angels and archangels and all the company of heaven, we got all the company of heaven on our side. And some people have gone very, very deeply into these spiritual disciplines and fortunately have left us a record of their experiments. I passed out a bibliography. I don't know, I don't even recall how many classified. I tried to steer away from heavy-duty stuff, I think, on a lot of these. Yeah, I don't have a lot of the Cloud of Unknowing, which is the last one on the list by Anonymous. But there are many, many people, the spiritual exercises, for example, of St. Ignatius. So we don't have to look for a teacher. You don't have to look at me. You say, my goodness, I got to find some live guru, you know, our master. We've got masters who maybe died 100 years ago or 500 years ago or 1800 years ago, and they can still we can still learn from them. Now I want to again, I've been here for 3 weeks and I've been real remiss in pointing out the books that I wanted to recommend. These are all in the bookstore, and Celebration of Discipline is a very good beginner's book. It has 12 disciplines, and you named almost all of them. In fact, you named a few that he doesn't have in here, but he's got them arranged in three: inner, outer, and corporate. And the inward disciplines he calls meditation, prayer, fasting, and study as inner disciplines. Then outward disciplines are simplicity, solitude, submission, and service. And corporate disciplines, and those are the kind of things that you do with your congregation or with a group of Christians, are confession. We don't have confession up there. Worship. Incidentally, Foster is a Quaker. He's not a Catholic. So when you got a confession in there, you have to listen a little bit, because when a Quaker says confession is an important corporate discipline, I listen to that. Worship, guidance, and celebration. And guidance is another one that's, I think, almost unheard of in our congregations. Let me interject this. I guess I'm giving you a very general introduction here. I want to get just a little bit more specific possibly with one of these disciplines, but you know, it's hopeless to cover 12 disciplines in an hour. So. But I do want to emphasize, so you don't misunderstand it, I said at the beginning that spiritual disciplines are not laws. I want to say again that spiritual disciplines are not ends in themselves. And if you ever look at a discipline as an end in itself, say, for example, fasting, you're going down the tubes, because that will absolutely kill the freedom that the discipline is supposed to give us, the liberation, okay? So the goal of any spiritual discipline is the glorious freedom of the children of God, not the discipline itself. If the discipline is our focus, then we lose the freedom. And I think that is precisely what Jesus sees in the Pharisees. He says to his, to the people, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees, you'll never even see the kingdom of God. My righteousness doesn't even get close to the Pharisees, let alone exceeding it. I mean, they would have been keepers of the spiritual disciplines as high as this mountain back here is over the molehill out here compared with me. The problem is the discipline had become an end in itself. It was a matter of keeping the discipline, and the discipline has no value in itself. Okay, well, I said I would pick do one talk a little bit about one discipline, and I just decided to talk for a few minutes here about one that maybe is a little bit more thorny, and that's the one of submission. I believe somebody, I think it was Lowell and Carol Erdahl, did something on equality in marriage, and there's a lot about submission and so forth in that. I think the discipline has its roots in Jesus' call to us, if anyone would come after me, let them deny themselves and take up a cross and follow me. It has to do with self-denial, and self-denial is not self-contempt. It's not the same thing. In a sense, what it has to do with is laying down the burden of needing always to have your own way. That's essentially what the discipline of submission is all about. Now, we may argue, I got to have my own way, because what I'm talking about here is a critical issue We cannot compromise on it. I mean, I am right, and I'm not going to submit, and I submit to you that 999 times out of 1,000, what it is we're standing for really isn't that strong. I think we carry around with us a burden of having our own way. We do this in congregations. I mean, by George, you know, we're not going to move from the red hymnal to the green one, or we're not going to, you know, I'm not going to bring a guitar into the church that doesn't belong, or whatever the thing is. We get into fights and we argue with one another. Here's where the discipline of submission really, I think, becomes important. But the importance of the discipline is the spirit of the discipline of submission, not some legalistic letter of law about that discipline. And what it basically, I think, comes down to is a very, very radical kind of thing, because Jesus, in his teaching, which results in the discipline of submission, reverses the whole notion of the world's idea of greatness. And that's essentially what's coming out in this. It's radical social teaching. You see, Jesus didn't just die a cross death. He lived a cross life. That's the whole shooting match right there. And so he comes along and he flatly rejects all the cultural givens and all the things that even that could have been attributed to him. Somebody comes up to him and says, "Good master." He says, "Hold it. Why do you call me good? There's one good, but God, you know." He says to his followers, don't have people call you master and rabbi. He flatly rejects all the cultural givens. He says to his followers, you are to be servants. That's the cross lifestyle. He did away with all of the cultural claims to privilege and status. Just simply didn't recognize them. How many of you were here this morning for John's keynote kind of thing? Quite a few. Well, John read a story at the very end that is just incredible about this poor man in New York City. To make a long story short, he ends up in court over something. He's to be a witness, but he won't swear on the Bible. He won't take the oath, you know. And this gets him in trouble and lands him in jail. I have a friend in Kalamazoo who did. Essentially, I suppose, would be an act of civil disobedience, and for this he was brought to trial. It was a jury trial, and my friend happens to be a Quaker, and as you know, they take some of this stuff rather seriously. One thing Quakers don't do is stand up for somebody. I mean, they don't. They try to do away with the notion of that there are some people more important than others. So, of course, when the judge comes into a courtroom, whatever the guy's, the tip staff or bailiff or whatever his name is, comes in and says, hear ye, you know, Judge Olmsted, now presiding in the circuit court, so-and-so, all rise. Jack is a gentle Quaker. In pretrial hearing for the judge, explained to the judge that he was a Quaker and that he would, I mean, that was part of his stance. I mean, the judge was no more important to him than the lowliest visitor in the courtroom. And so the judge was a very understanding man also, and he simply came into the courtroom and sat down, and nobody said, please rise, the judge is here. They did away with the issue like that. But I mean, I think what Jack is sort of getting at there was this idea of doing away with privilege and status. It's a whole new call to leadership. I mean, a whole radical redefinition of what it means to be a leader. And so that the cross life, which I think submission is a part of that whole thing, undermines social order. It's a very radical thing. And I think that Jesus' teaching about denying ourselves and taking up a cross also informs the early church and finds its way into the epistles. But, oh, I didn't bring the Bible. I was going to read that. I've forgotten about it. Anybody got one? Yeah, grab a Bible and just look up a couple of passages that might help us with that. What Jesus really inaugurates under this discipline of submission is a staggering new order. Take a look at, well, Philippians 2, 4 to 7. would be one passage to read. Got three of them here, so.
2:1-7?
4-7.
4-7.
Grab another Bible.
Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men.
Okay, why don't you look up 1 Peter 2, 21-23, and while he's doing that, you look up Ephesians 5:21. We'll get the next two out of the way. 1 Peter 2, 21-23.
For it would have been better for them never to have known the way of righteousness than after knowing it to turn back from the holy commandment delivered to them. It has happened to them according to the true proverb, the dog turns back to his own vomit and the sow is washed only to wallow in the mire.
That's not the passage I picked. I must have written it wrong, or you looked it up wrong. Is that 1 Peter 2:21?
2 Peter.
2 Peter, okay. Try 1 Peter. I don't want to hear about dogs throwing up.
21 through 22? 23. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, no guile was found on his lips. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he trusted to him who judges justly.
Good. That's a little better.
A little better.
Try Ephesians 5:21.
Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ.
Okay. Now notice that in that discipline, it has to do with what Christ has done for us, and it has to do with imitation of Christ in that regard. And that's a staggering new social order, because all other appeals to social, to submission, in a sense, appeal to that's how the gods have ordered it. And there would certainly have been submission in Jesus' day. Submission to emperors, slaves submissive to their masters, and all that kind of stuff. And even when you stop and think about it, when the women are addressed, a woman is addressed in one of Paul's letters, wives be subject to your husbands out of reverence for Christ. In a sense, if you could stop and think your way back into their social setting, there was no need to say that. Wives were subject to their husbands, period. I mean, why would even a thing like that have been said? It is implicit in the request is addressing a woman as a moral agent who can make a decision. That's new in that day. The Christian subordination appeals to the example of Christ. Have this mind among you, which you have in Christ Jesus, though he had all the rights and so forth. He didn't think that was something to be hung on to, but became a servant. So, really, there is no subordination or superordination in the Christian discipline of submission. It is being servants to one another. Okay, I want to read about a couple more things from Foster.
Mm-hmm. You said a few minutes ago that the cross life undermines basically social, and I'm not exactly sure the word you use, social order.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying now doesn't seem to say that. I think I'm a little confused on that point. I don't think Christ is telling us to destroy the social order or have cause upheaval within it.
Okay, well, I guess I just have to try to, this is delicate, try to make a distinction here. Jesus did not tell us to go out and destroy the social order. What he did was bring a new social order which within it is going to burst the present order of things. You know, he said it to his disciples, that in the world those who are the kings and the rulers lord it over the subjects. It shall not be so among you. Anyone who would be great among you must become servant of all. But I think if that begins to be practiced radically and consistently all the way, it just comes head to head with the social order. It begins to crack all of the illusions that we have about how things work. That's what I mean. It is not a call to go out and smash something. It's, if you start living this way, it's like it's like planting an acorn in a 1 gallon glass jug. When it starts to grow, the jug breaks finally, you know. I mean, I think that's the breaking in of the kingdom of God. It just does in the old order. Now, that does, I mean, here we are 2,000 years later, and the old order is still pretty powerful. But wherever the kingdom is breaking in, the old order gets turned upside down. Just, in fact, there is a passage in the, I think, in Acts. See how these Christians are turning the world upside down. I mean, that's how it was perceived. It was that radical. And Jesus himself was brought to trial and condemned because he was perceived as a very high threat. I mean, it's hard for us to perceive a meek and mild, namby-pamby Jesus, you know. He's just nice and he blesses children and goes around. Well, why in the world would they kill somebody? He was perceived as a very serious threat to the existing order on the basis of his teaching and the way he behaved. That's all I'm saying.
In that session, I think it was yesterday, Civil Disobedience, we read a number of passages, and it was interesting that Jesus did some things that were countercultural and counter-religious on the Sabbath. You know, all mm-hmm. the things that he could have done on Monday,
yes,
or
could
Friday.
Have, could have waited.
But he didn't on the Sabbath day, you know, to, I think, visibly protest that their customs were boxing up God, their beliefs were dehumanizing people and all kinds of things. And he really worked to make it very clear that he was busting those things open. That, like you say, the ushering in of the kingdom was turning the worldly kingdom upside down.
Yes, and isn't this the new wine in the old wineskins?
Yep.
I'm always like that. The whole thing just busts. If you put, it does, if you put new wine in these old skins. So really, when the Holy Spirit catches a charismatic congregation, you'd better look out. You know, tremendous outbursts of praise and thanksgiving and so on. Dear me, they think, well, really, they are wild Christians. I've experienced that week by week on Thursday. It's just amazing, the praise and joy. You were saying there's a lot of joy in this. And I think that some of this really, certainly for me, need to come into the experience of joy.
Mm-hmm. And celebration in itself.
Celebration, and often celebration by a very humble celebrant.
Mm-hmm. This hour is drawn to a close, and I guess I need to wrap this up. I want to, again, point out some books to you that are helpful. That book, Celebration of Discipline, which is in the bookstore, is a very fine book to begin with because it's just very simple and gives you the sense of the freedom of it. The Freedom of Simplicity, which is another book by Richard Foster, which takes the one discipline of simplicity and goes into it in great depth. And this is a book that I just have found very delightful. It's called The Experience of Praying. It's by Sean Caulfield. He's a Trappist monk with just a delightful sense of humor and in a sort of an oblique way of seeing things. Just open your eyes to a whole lot of neat stuff. And it's not a how-to-do-it book, but at the end of every chapter, there is a little bit that says what to do. And he gives you just a few little clues of some things to do for your own meditation and what have you. Chuck?
I thought when we were talking about why we don't do discipline, you had mentioned the fact that most of us as Lutherans have been trained about work righteousness, you know, and that sometimes discipline can be viewed as work righteousness, and there may be a tender line there to be drawn, or something to be cautious about, that we don't think our own cross life or our own sacrificial living or our own disciplines. You know, Jesus was not really a model, he was it. You know, and we have to keep that in mind. But we are shy. I think Lutherans are really kind of shy.
Very gun shy.
Of discipline. Yeah. And we lost something because I personally am very shy of discipline.
There's a great danger in it. I mean, every one of these disciplines carries with it a concurrent danger. And I think that's one of the things that Foster points out about each discipline. Here's the danger in this one. Here's the danger in this one. But the constant emphasis on the discipline as a no value by itself. The discipline is only a means for the liberation of this part of my life. It's the liberation in Christ that we're looking for, not the discipline. And, you know, I guess there's always the difficulty keeping the scales in balance. You know, it got way out of balance this way, and then Luther comes along and says, we are saved by grace through faith alone. Wham! And it went, so we just threw all the, you know, everything else out. And that, there has to be some kind of balance. That is, it's like whether we come to God with our hands in our pockets or with our hands out to receive a gift. You know, that's that kind of thing.
One more thought. The discipline, we need discipline. And discipline has a value until it becomes the rod, you know, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. sort of beats us. Then I think it has lost its value.
And that's why the disciplines, I think, should fit together. That's why, you know, like say something like fasting has to also be coupled with guidance. You know, that's why you have a community. It's not just a solitary thing, but that you have someone listening to you. And that's really important. Sometimes the guidance can come from one person, not necessarily the pastor in your church. Sometimes the guidance can come from the whole congregation. I don't know how any congregations that would give corporate guidance. We try to do that in our community, and it's not easy to do, but it's possible.
Discipline always means giving up to whether it be time or yourself or whatever. You always have to give to take on the discipline.
Yep.
That's not easy.
Nope. Well, I want to close this by reading something to you. In fact, I quoted a little bit of this last night in that round table thing we had over there. But this is from Thomas Merton's New Seeds of Contemplation. I think it's fairly insightful, and he wrote this a long time ago, 20 years ago, I guess. It's at the end of one of his little meditations, which is called The Root of War is Fear. And since this is the issue that's on the docket today, I'd like to just read it because here are some insight that has come out of a contemplative and someone who's practicing a discipline of meditation, and to show you that it isn't just all got to do with spiritual or ethereal things. This is really strong words, but it's touched me. If people really wanted peace, they would sincerely ask God for it, and He would give it to them. But why should God give the world a peace which it does not really desire? The peace the world pretends to desire is really no peace at all. To some, peace merely means the liberty to exploit other people without fear of retaliation or interference. To others, peace means the freedom to rob others without interruption. To still others, it means the leisure to devour the goods of the earth without being compelled to interrupt their pleasures to feed those whom their greed is starving. And to practically everybody, peace simply means the absence of any physical violence that might cast a shadow over lives devoted to the satisfaction of their animal appetites for comfort and pleasure. Many persons like these have asked God for what they thought was peace and wondered why their prayer was not answered. They could not understand that it actually was answered. God left them with what they desired, for their idea of peace was only another form of war. The Cold War is simply the normal consequence of our corrupt idea of a peace based on a policy of everyone for oneself in ethics, economics, and political life. It is absurd to hope for a solid peace based on fictions and illusions. Now, the spiritual disciplines are what begin to get deep enough to touch that. But now I don't need to touch it in you, see. He goes on and says, so instead of loving what you think is peace, love others and love God above all. So the first commandment is, you shall have no other gods before me. Luther's explanation was, fear, love, and trust in God above all things. That means I fear God more than I do the Russians. And instead of hating the people that you think are war makers, hate the appetites and the disorder in your own soul. which are the causes of war. If you love peace, then hate injustice, hate tyranny, hate greed, but hate these things in yourself, not in the others.